I am here with Catherine Stewart. Catherine, thanks for joining me.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I recently discovered you. You wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, which they titled, "Now Will We Believe What Is Happening Right in Front of Us?" And I want to talk about what's happening right in front of us. But before we do, perhaps you can summarize your background as a journalist.
Sure. I've been an investigative journalist and reporter. My new book, Money Lies in God, Inside the Movement to Destroy American Democracy, is my third book on the anti-democratic movement, which involves the religious right, the new right, a number of kind of different features, sometimes sort of, I would say, swimming in the same headwaters, but often with kind of different contours, each group.
Yeah, so your book comes out next week, which is probably when we're dropping this. So I think we're probably dropping this on your pub date. So your book, Money Lies in God, which I just got the PDF of yesterday. So I must say I have not read every word of it, but I've read a lot of it, and we'll get into it, but we will by no means exhaust what is of interest in there. So let's find a way into this, I guess, starting with the current moment politically, because it's genuinely confusing how these reactionary forces in American politics are intersecting and supporting one another. We have many allies of convenience, it seems. I mean, these people are not ideologically unified. You have Christian nationalists, you have oligarchs, some of whom are Christian, or nominally so, some of whom believe not much of anything. Some are quite reactionary Catholics who have been in the woodwork for many generations, it seems, and seem to be influential on the Supreme Court and elsewhere. And it's a little strange to dissect all of this. It's also difficult to see how all of this summates in the person of an orange monstrosity of Donald Trump. Let's start with your op-ed, and then we'll get into the book. What do you think is happening right in front of us that we should be concerned about?
I mean, they told us that they were going to dismantle the institutions of our democracy, and that's exactly what they were what they're doing now. You know, this is a movement that, frankly, has been quite clear about what their aims are. They're not hiding. It's just that a lot of people haven't been listening. You know, I get into the different features of the movement in my book, Money, Lies, and God. I'd like to start with the title, if that's all right.
Sure.
I mean, money, because money is a huge part of the story. A sort of vast concentrations of wealth over the past decades have actually sort of at the tippy top of the economic spectrum, have kind of destabilized the political system in a number of different ways. They've created resentments among large, massive working people, and empowered people at the very top to sort of put their thumb on our politics in certain kinds of ways. Lies, because disinformation and conspiracism is a huge piece of this. You know, it's how a lot of the rank and file have been kind of separated from the facts in certain ways, or had their resentments directed toward targets that really perhaps don't deserve it quite as much as they get it. And then, of course, God, because religious nationalism, I think, is the most important ideological framework for the largest part of this movement. So in the book, I get into a group I call the funders. These are the beneficiaries of those vast concentrations of wealth. And, you know, religiously, they're all over the place. I'm thinking about people like the Corkrees or Skyfe Foundation or Sean Feiler or Barry Side or the DeVos Prince family juggernaut, the Wilkes brothers, Tom Dunn, some of them are like evangelical, some are Catholic, some are Protestant, some are Jewish, some are frankly atheistic or nihilistic and don't seem to believe in anything more than money. But they all agree on the need to sort of crush liberalism, and investing a portion of their fortunes on the destruction, on these anti-democratic projects. I also shine a bright light on a group I call the Thinkers. These, many of them are associated with a movement called the New Right. A number of them, like Russell Vogt and Darren Beatty and others, are now, and Michael Anton, occupying positions in the Trump administration or nominees. And I would say some of them are more religious nationalist or Christian nationalist than others. Many of them also seem quite nihilistic. Some of them actually derive a lot of inspiration from political theorists associated with the Nazis. I kid you not.
Mm-hmm. Carl Schmitt.
Right, Carl Schmitt. Yeah. I mean, there more was a Nazi political theorist who, you know, we can talk about him a little bit later and how his ideology has influenced this movement. But they are actually more anti, I would say, hostile to the idea of democracy. And they've been saying for a long time that they abhor democracy and its principles and institutions, even as they claim to revere the founders and our and our founding principles. Also look at the rank and file, the people who sort of tend to vote for candidates who are radically anti-democratic in their political aims. And then I also look at the sort of cadre of very empowered political pastors and activists, religious activists, groups I call the sergeants and the power players. And often they're the ones kind of driving the agenda and playing a very important role in connecting with the rank and file.
Mm. Well, let's start with the thinkers. There was this political talking point during the election that was dismissed by all of Trump's fans and by Trump himself as just pure misinformation. The Democratic Party was quite agitated over something called Project 2025, which is this massive document put out by the Heritage Foundation, which seemed to be a plan, a fairly reactionary plan for making some impressive changes in governance in America. As you know, Trump pretended to know nothing about it. When he heard something about it, he said he wanted nothing to do with it. I remember, you know, I have some friends, if you can imagine this, who voted for Donald Trump. And I remember raising the specter of Project 2025 to them, and they assured me that this was misinformation spun up by the left. This is not a thing. Some maniacs over at the Heritage Foundation wrote something which Trump had never heard of. There's no coordination here. But you've just mentioned some of the names that are now staffing the administration, and these are some of the primary authors of Project 2025. Russell Vogt, director of the Office of Management and Budget, he, I believe, is the primary author of the document. Brendan Carr, Peter Navarro, Tom Homan, John Radcliffe, Michael Anton. You know, John Radcliffe is nominated to lead the CIA. This is Project 2025 in its implementation. And it's amazing to me that you hear that there's no mea culpa ever uttered by any of the fans of Trump who wanted nothing to do with Project 2025 and were quite happy to know that he knew nothing about it. That none of them are now stepping in front of microphones saying, you know, this is not really what I voted for, right? And so how do you perceive this? Was this, if you can imagine, was Trump just lying when he said he knew nothing about Project 2025 and wanted nothing to do with it? Or what's happening here?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Russell Vogt was caught on camera speaking with a potential funder of the movement. It was a kind of a setup by a couple of British journalists, essentially saying that, yeah, you know, he's in on it and this is what's going to happen. The idea that this was sort of a 900-page document that was never going to go anywhere is just total fiction. I mean, many of the contributors to Project 2025 were former members of the Trump administration. And yes, you're absolutely right. A number of contributors and architects of Project 2025 are now occupying key institutions, you know, key positions within the new administration. And what we see in Project 2025 is a kind of marriage of the new right and the Christian right and the Christian nationalist movement. That's kind of those two influences comprise sort of, I would say, I'd call them the power couple of the anti-democratic movement.
The power couple being Christian nationalism and the new right.
And the new right, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, what is Christian nationalism in your view? Because it's not synonymous with the evangelical movement. I mean, I'm sure there's impressive overlap there, but how would you differentiate it from the various flavors of Christianity we have in America?
Yeah, thank you. You know, Christian nationalism is not Christianity. It's not a religion. It's both an ideology, like, and also a kind of political movement. I think of it as like a mindset and a machine. So the mindset draws on this ideology that says America was founded as a Christian nation, according to a very particular understanding of the Christian faith, and our laws should be based on reactionary interpretation of the Bible. And it's a sort of exploitation of this ideology for politics and power. And when we're talking about the machine, it's a political movement. The movement is leadership driven, and it's also organization driven. And we can sort of divide those, you know, the agenda is not set by the rank and file. I mean, let's really be clear about that. So the organizations can be divided into categories. There are right-wing policy groups. There are advocacy, legal advocacy groups. There are very sophisticated data initiatives. There are legislative initiatives. There are networking organizations like the Council for National Policy, which gets different factions of the leadership on the same page. And, you know, the movement is, there's a vast kind of messaging sphere that goes out and reaches the rank and file. There are these pastoral networks, groups like Watchmen on the Wall and Faith Wins and Church United and the Courage Tour, these initiatives that draw pastors into networks, and then movement leaders will do presentations with them and give them materials. They get them to turn out to their congregations to turn out to vote for the sort of hard right candidates that the movement favors. And those pastoral networks play a really important role in election cycles because, listen, sort of the rank and file of this movement represent a minority of the population. And frankly, I think even many, if most American Christians object to Christian nationalism, a number of organizations like Christians Against Christian Nationalism and the New Evangelicals and Vote Common Good, I mean, the Baptist Joint Committee, there are so many others object to Christian nationalism. Mm. But this is a group.
Does anyone answer to the name Christian nationalist happily, or is that a phrase that is used by those outside the movement to describe it pejoratively?
Some do. Like Russell Vogt, I think, has self-identified as Christian nationalist. We know Marjorie Taylor Greene and some others have. You know, I just want to say, return for a moment to that infrastructure. The strength of the movement is in that dense organizational infrastructure, and they turn out their vote in disproportionate numbers. But, you know, Christian nationalism, I think of it like authoritarianism. It's a political dynamic that affects a political system, not just a set of attitudes embraced by the rank and file. So let's say, you know, when a person decides they're going to vote their values on abortion, say they they're voting to protect the American family as they think they're doing, you know, as the movement has told them to do. They may not necessarily be arguing for major changes in the way our government is run. They're just kind of making a statement about their identity and what they value in themselves. So we might not call them a Christian nationalist, but what they are doing is lending support to a Christian nationalist agenda. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
It's like authoritarianism. It doesn't just start off as like a political program that everybody endorses. It's just like various dynamics and sort of interests act to sort of promote a kind of authoritarian agenda.
What is the overlap, would you say, between Christian nationalism and what we would call, you know, the white supremacist movement in the U.S.?
I mean, we have to really look at a Venn diagram. There's some overlap, but it's not the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, but it's what's very interesting is that there are a group like the Proud Boys. When they first started, they didn't really particularly have a religious identity. But as the Christian nationalist movement has gained power, and as these different identity movements, by the way, somewhat of these white nationalist groups have had, I mean, just want to be very clear, some of them have had a religious identity from the start, others have not. Mm-hmm. So there's differences among them, but as the movement has gained in strength and as their leaders have been able to sort of see the power that the ideology and the movement sort of is able to marshal, some have adopted, like the Proud Boys, for instance, has adopted more of a religious identity more overtly. So there is some variation in the different sort of militia groups and white nationalist groups.
So there are obviously many ways into this. I mean, there are people who are just racist and afraid of immigration, and then they get some religious inspiration in their politics, and they find themselves standing somewhere near a sincere Christian who finds that their politics is also bent around by the scenes of chaos at the southern border and wants to get a handle on that and can't figure out why anyone left of center is confused about why we would want a defensible border. And you have people who, you know, are associated with an institute like the Claremont Institute, where, you know, you have intellectuals or erstwhile intellectuals. I think in your book you detail how that institution has undergone some considerable devolution in terms of its scholarly integrity. But you have people there who I think would never answer to the name of white supremacist and would at least in their own minds consciously disavow racism, but nonetheless have time for, you know, Nazi writers like the one we named, Carl Schmitt, and people he's influenced. Again, I'm trying to figure out how to talk about a fairly complex Venn diagram that is clearly in the real world deranging our politics at this moment. You have, you know, the oligarchs, you know, many of whom we'll talk about, many of whom I know personally, some of whom I know not to be religious at all, some of whom I know are religious in a strange way that probably has as much to do with Burning Man as the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But, you know, these are people who are influenced, you know, will admit to being influenced by rather iconoclastic and free associative, and I would even say confabulatory thinkers like Curtis Yarvin.
Curtis Yarvin.
so it's just a mess ideologically out there, and yet they're having a good old time at Mar-a-Lago now, seeming to get everything they want out of the world, I think to the obvious detriment of our democracy and American values. What strand of this do you want to pick up first?
Oh my gosh, so much to talk about. I mean, when we're talking about the oligarchs, I mean, let's be clear, it's not all of the very rich people in this country that are supporting this. It's a sector, right, who are supporting it. And I think that, I mean, something that comes to mind when you talk about these guys going to Mar-a-Lago and sort of, you know, having a grand old time, I think a lot of people don't appreciate the degree to which a lot of these very rich people live in almost like islands, right? They're surrounded by people who say nice things to them. They, you know, have the sense that they can sort of, you know, deserve every penny that they earned, every penny where they have with their bare hands. Many of them, by the way, you know, they want policies that benefit their businesses. They want deregulatory environments so that they can engage in, so some of them are in polluting practices, and others just in, you know, they run monopolistic businesses and they want an absence of regulation in ways that are going to assist those businesses. But at the same time, they also want, I would say, protective policies. You know, they want often privileged contracts, or they want, in some instances, I'm looking at you, Mr. Musk, tax privileges, tax subsidies, and things like this. But they're also living on these islands, and they, you know, in the last couple of decades, we've seen a massive concentration of wealth at the very tippy top. But we've also seen life become so much harder for people, I would say, in the bottom 90% of our country, where the working and middle classes are struggling, you know, and making it hard, it's making it harder for those families to succeed. And so people at the top in their islands are sort of protected, but they can hear from like far, like over the walls, they can hear, you know, critics saying, well, you know, what you're doing is really not okay. You should be paying your taxes and perhaps treating your workforce a little better. And maybe not killing off all those mom and pops or smaller organizations with your, you know, monopolistic businesses. And they don't like that. It makes them very defensive. And I think that that contributes to this sense of, you know, sense that, like, I think they're afraid of the people coming after them with proverbial pitchforks. And I think that actually contributes that sense of defensiveness to some of their activities in supporting this movement. I mean, we can't know what's in people's hearts, obviously, and I'm sure there's different variants. I think the Wilkes brothers are very different from Jeff Yass, for instance, in their orientation in every way, or Peter Thiel. But at the same time, again, they have embraced these people like Curtis Yarvin and his fellow travelers at the Claremont Institute, who are basically arguing that we need more monarchical form of rule, that democracy is not sufficient to solve all of our problems because we're facing an absolute apocalypse because of the woke cancelers or whatever. It's like, well, who's really trying to cancel stuff here? I mean, I'm sure you, like I, saw that list of words that these sort of funded National Institutes of Health studies mm-hmm. are not allowed to include, including the word woman.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about socioeconomic I know.
They're basically, so they're just for people who don't know what's happening there, they circulated a, I believe I saw it as an Excel spreadsheet of keywords that were now going to be screened for in any scientific grant at the National Science Foundation. And if you take the complete set of words, I mean, some were obviously red flags for DEI-inflected work, but I mean, the complete set seemed to rule out more or less all of the social sciences. I mean, if a word like woman and socioeconomic is going to get you flagged, then it's, we're really just talking about physics in the end.
Yeah.
Okay, so well, you mentioned the woke stuff. This is one place where I think you and I might disagree.
Maybe, maybe not.
It'll be interesting to figure out why we disagree if we in fact disagree. But in reading your book and in reading, since it was given to me as a PDF, I had the advantage of being able to find every use of the word woke and wokeness in it. Just so I'm pretty sure I understand what you said about it in your book. You seem to think that it's basically a non-issue, and insofar as the people on the right are,
did I say that in my book?
Well, no. Feel free to correct me again. I'm throwing myself on your mercy because I did not read your whole book, but I did read much of it. But you seem to think, the impression I've gotten, however haphazardly, is that you think that the right has made a demon out of this idea that the left is engaged in a kind of, you know, quasi-Marxist, and certainly postmodernist takeover of all elite institutions. And there's
well, I think you should perhaps read the section I write about the far left.
Okay.
So
okay.
I take aim at that as well.
Let me put all these dumb ideas in your mouth, and you can spit them
okay.
out at me. You seem to think that this is either these fears are not sincerely held, or if held, they're exaggerated, and there's much less of a problem on the left than is made out by people like Christopher Rufo or James Lindsay or any of these other activists in the new mm-hmm. right who stand up in front of adoring crowds and say the woke mind virus is coming for you and your kids. Your kids' schools are trying to make them trans, et cetera. This is obviously something that Elon Musk has spoken about, and insofar as I know his mind at all anymore, I believe he along with many millions of other people in this country is sincere in saying that he is one of his major concerns is this far left trans activists centered ideology.
Yeah, I think you should actually read.
Sorry,
more
so just,
of
well,
my
give
book.
It. I don't have
it's
to read
really
it. You're going to give it to
okay.
me right now.
I mean,
let
I
me
think
have
it's
it.
Very clear that the far left is frankly there's on that sector of the far left. There is the amplification of some very divisive stuff that frankly redounds to the benefit of the far right.
Yeah,
because what it often does, it's and we saw it like the labs at MIT Media Lab, for instance, analyzed this as did I think it was a sector of. It was like a Harvard lab that collaborated on some of this stuff where they found some of these extremist ideas being amplified by Russia and other hostile foreign actors in order to divide. You know, some of these ideas are incredibly divisive. And one of the things that this does is it sort of makes people think, the moderate liberal, progressive left, they sort of throw all of it into that sort of woke communist bucket, which is ridiculous. I mean, the people who are talking about these issues constantly are people on the right. You know, I was recently at America Fest. It's an annual gathering held by Turning Point USA. It took place in Phoenix, Arizona. There were 20,000 sort of hardcore MAGA. Mm. Every single speaker had to talk about transgender women in sports. This is like, you're right. They're making a boogeyman out of this issue. Now, whatever you or I may think about these issues, and we'll probably find a lot of agreement on this particular topic, we have 11.4 million children living in poverty. Gun violence is the number one cause of death among children and teenagers in our country. Those kinds of issues can and many DEI programs as well, can and should be examined. And are there excesses in some of the DEI programs? Of course there are. But is this the major problem facing our country When you bring up James Lindsay and Rufo and Musk, even, you know, Lindsay, at least, I saw speak at a Moms for Liberty conference where he's going on and on about how, you know, the Democratic Party is like communist China. Those extremist voices are not normalized. They're not like widespread within, I would say, Democratic Party politics. It's the right that talks about them all the time. It's a massive distraction. I mean, I think we have to, you know, whatever you or I may think about those issues, we have to acknowledge that they are being used as a massive distraction from the real problems facing our country, bread and butter issues. You know, this is a movement that claims to stand for the American family, but they're endorsing politicians whose policies are making it so much harder for so many Americans to succeed. And, you know, why would they talk about this these issues constantly? Well, it's like, you ever see a laser pointer or a cat toy where there's this red little thing that goes all over the floor and the cat jumps at it and jumps at it? Well, if you're focused on that, like, identity issue that involves sex and sexuality, which distracts everybody, all of a sudden you're not looking at the real problems in your community. You're not looking at the source of the problems. You're not understanding why the cost of groceries is too high and the cost of housing is impossible, and why you're like a couple with, you know, two parents and four jobs, and you're still struggling to make it work.
Right. Well, I agree with that, that it's been a massive distraction that has been leveraged quite artfully and cynically by the far right. But it was also a massive distraction for on the left, for the Democratic Party, and all of the elite institutions, the mainstream media and scientific journals and universities and Hollywood. All of them got captured to a degree that I think the far right perceived to, and rightly perceived to be a problem and a massive political vulnerability. So it's not just the laser pointer, this tiny little dot that should be meaningless but is captivating everyone.
Well, I would say the right is really good at getting, I mean, they're in way more tactical. They're really good at setting traps for people to walk into.
But there was no reason
to
walk
in. Them
there was
to,
no reason to, for Kamala Harris or anyone else in the Democratic Party to walk into those traps if they had their head screwed on straight around how fringe some of the and insane some of these concerns actually are on the far left. I mean, we had during, I'll take you back to the golden years of woke derangement, you know, to somewhere around 2020. I mean, you literally had NPR publishing an editorial in defense of looting, right? We had just seen, you know, lots of looting and rioting in major cities associated with the George Floyd
protest. Oh, I mean, that's appalling. But that was also just one fringe idea in, like, the free marketplace of ideas. And you see a lot of crazy ideas on the right as well. And I'm not familiar with the editorial, but it sounds appalling.
That's the thing but there's perhaps this is something you have an idea about how to fix. There is, many of us have noticed, a pervasive asymmetry here where the left or anyone left of center, any mainstream institution, the New York Times, say, gets one thing wrong and it is devastating for its reputation.
The right amplifies it over and
yes,
over.
Yes, and the right will seize upon that error as a sign that there is no distinction between the New York Times and, you know, the Epoch Times or Breitbart or Fox News, right? We're all just in the business of smearing everyone all day long for political reasons. The right gets things wrong, and there's just, since they're continuously playing tennis without the net over there, it never matters. And there's nothing to be made of it left of center, because of course we know that Fox News and Breitbart they're really not in the business of journalism. They're going, you know, they're misinformation factories. So there's this profound asymmetry here, which is that left of center in elite institutions, we are trying to hold ourselves to journalistic and academic standards, and we succeed or fail at that and police ourselves and are policed from the outside by, you know, cynical people who want no part of the standards and the norms we're trying to defend, but will hold us to those standards and norms and reveal us in every moment of hypocrisy that can be detected, right? And so it is a kind of, you know, this is like, again, it's asymmetric warfare of the sort that you see when you have a major army that's trying to, you know, follow the rules of the Geneva Convention, fighting an insurgency that is using IEDs and human shields and, you know, putting the barrels of his rifles on the shoulders of children. And it's very hard to know how to navigate this rhetorically, right? Because every time you admit, yes, okay, the deplatforming of the New York Post on Twitter in response to the Hunter Biden laptop, yes, in retrospect, that looked like a bad idea. Yes, those former intelligence chiefs who signed a letter saying that it looks like Russian disinformation. Well, yeah, they do have egg on their face now because it wasn't Russian disinformation. But that does not obviate all of the concerns about Russian disinformation that sane journalists had in mind, you know, the previous week. And it does not make Rudy Giuliani foisting an October surprise with the Hunter Biden laptop somehow an honest broker of information at this point. And it becomes impossible to make these distinctions because, again, there's this profound asymmetry. One error on your side destroys your reputation. The other side plays by no rules at all.
That's true. And I think one of the most dangerous consequences of this movement is an assault on the idea of truth itself, the idea that truth doesn't matter, facts don't matter, a sort of contempt for expertise, the contempt for science in a certain way, a certain type of science, and a contempt for this idea that the truth is nothing but an instrument in for power, and so you can just lie as much as you want. It is an asymmetric war, and it's very unfortunate because I think people who are sort of on the moderate, liberal, progressive side take truth seriously and are. Have to care. Does that make sense? And meanwhile, the other side engages in a lot of trollish behavior and sort of playground bullying behavior, name calling, lying outright, and then never, you know, moving the goalposts more and more. And that becomes another way of destroying democracy.
Yeah, they never correct
their
errors.
Accountability.
It's interesting to see what someone does when an error is pointed out, even an error that is wherein you can trace some obvious harms that followed from it, right? I mean, people who, like, you know, Elon Musk and Donald Trump made light of the attack on Paul Pelosi, right? And spread, you know, lies and misinformation around that story. On that side of our politics, no one ever has to apologize for getting anything wrong. Even if you're getting it wrong at scale where you now have, you know, people getting doxxed and having to leave their homes or having to get, you know, private security, et cetera. On the left, or, you know, in what remains of liberal politics, again, I mean, the left is a confusing term at this point, there is this burden, which is a burden we should happily embrace, to keep track of your mistakes and to correct them insofar as that's possible, right? And in some cases, it's not obvious how to print a retraction. I mean, if you and I say something that's mistaken on this podcast, you know, it's hard for me to know where to put our mea culpa next month when someone points out an error we've made. But in real journalism and in real scientific discourse, just in real intellectual discourse, when you have real historians really trying to figure out what happened last year or last century, they're playing a very different game than Tucker Carlson is playing on his podcast. Mm-hmm. And yet the people in power are the people in Tucker's audience now.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, this is where the lies and conscious disinformation is such an important feature of my book. You know, I went to, do you know what Reawaken America is?
No.
Okay.
No.
It's, I have a chapter. It's a traveling pro-MAGA conspiracy fest. They've held dozens of these gatherings all over the country, usually in mega churches. It's organized by some of Trump's most sort of loyal allies, people like Mike Flynn and Clay Clark, and usually one of the Trump sons shows up to speak at these gatherings. And I've been to three of them. And you walk into the space and you hear every conspiracy imaginable. It's like everybody's super pro-Trump and, you know, wearing their MAGA hats and carrying their gear. But you hear about the Great Replacement and don't let them microchip you. And, you know, the World Health Organization has 666 on, you know, emblazoned on it. And anybody who's, you know, against Trump is literally under the thumb of Satan. There's a lot of sort of spirit warrior talk, a lot of kind of, you know, this is in the spiritual war in the heavens is playing out in politics here and now. And if you're going against Trump, you're against God's will. And it's batshit. Mm. Allowed to say that.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's really crazy. But the sad thing is that there are dozens of these things. They've taken place all over the country. And there are a lot of YouTubers there and a lot of people with podcasts and people with radio shows and the like. And those kinds of lies are amplified and spread out all over the country. And a lot of these, they also have, by the way, at some of them, they'll have a separate gathering for pastors. Like there's this guy, Jason Lahmeyer, I think is how you pronounce his name. He's the head of a group called Pastors for Trump. So they'll have like all of these pastors there who are very political, you know, politicizing their congregations very actively. And that kind of messaging has really separated a lot of the rank and file from the facts. And the overarching message is one of fear. They will come after you in your home. They are going to control every dime you own. They're going to change your children's gender against their will, et cetera. And this kind of fear primes people. I think it's actually one of the sort of four, I would say, pieces of a mindset that drives people toward authoritarian politics. And I'd like to break that down for a minute if I can.
Sure.
This movement, first of all, promotes identity politics. You're with us or you're against us. You're pure or you're impure. You're one of us or one of them. That's what religious nationalism is. It's a kind of reaction, an exclusionary form of nationalism. You're like a proper American, a true conservative Christian American, or you're not, right? Then there is a kind of persecution complex. This idea that Christian conservatives are the most persecuted group in society. And that also serves to sort of unify the base. And then, of course, this apocalypticism, the sense that we're facing an absolute emergency. It's between God and the devil. It's between, you know, as Yarvin might not sort of put it in religious terms so much, but like, you know, it's the woke mind virus versus order, you know, the right kind of a Red Caesar or whatever. Mm. Things just don't work in a democracy. And all of that clears the way for the acceptance of a strong man, an authoritarian leader who will break the rules, who doesn't follow the law, who is a law unto himself. I mean, they often refer to him as like on the Christian nationalist side, they'll refer to him as a biblical king, like King Cyrus, an imperfect ruler that God chose to enact his will. Well, here's the thing about kings. They're not kings of democracies. They are the law and they establish the law. They don't have to be subject to any ethics constraints or any sort of congressional laws or anything like that. So this is one of the ways that you can destroy democracy and clear the way for a strong man. The funny thing is about, you know, a lot of people talk about what do Christian nationalists really want? Do they want a theocracy? And I would say yes and no. Like when you look at leaders all over the world who want to consolidate more authoritarian forms of political power, whether somebody like Putin in Russia or Erdogan in Turkey or leaders in Iran, right? When they want to consolidate more authoritarian dictatorial forms of power, they often surround themselves with holy men, with conservative representatives of their faith, with ultra-conservative clerics. They're binding themselves very tightly to these folks. They're bubble wrapping themselves in sanctimony. They're saying, you can't touch me. You can't investigate me. I've got the holy men on my side. I've got God on my side. And that is a sort of protective for them against any investigation of their corruption, their cronyism, the fact that they may be just enriching themselves and their cronies at the public expense. It guards against any investigation of abuses they're perpetrating against their own people, against the fact that their countries are actually, you know, there's a suppression of free speech, absolute no tolerance of political opposition. So I think these kinds of arrangements are more aptly described as cronyistic kleptocracies with incredibly repressive features and a kind of overlay of theocracy.
Yeah, well, say, again, I have to confess my confusion over what is actually happening here. Because, as you probably know, I've spent the first part of my career quite concerned about the collision between organized religion and modernity in at various points, whether it was theocratic Islam or Christianity. I was, you know, back when Bush was president, I was concerned that the Christian right seemed to be getting more and more of what it wanted in America. And I thought we had to push back against all that. With Trump, I've been dimly aware that the theocrats were getting happier and happier at the prospect of a second Trump term, you know, viewing him as a kind of instrument of God's mysterious work in the world. You know, I remember I ran into Ralph Reed at a conference. This is the first time around. It's probably around 2017 or so. And naively and incredulously asked him, you can't believe that Trump is really a Christian who shares your faith, who cares at all about creating a Christian nation. And, you know, he, as won't surprise you, defaulted to, you know, I can't know what's in another man's heart and only God can know and blah, blah, blah. Whereas I know quite what was certainly true is that he views Trump in the same way I view Trump, which is that he couldn't name the four Gospels. And, you know, when asked what his favorite book of the Bible was in that inadvertently hilarious interview, he didn't want to say because he really, quite literally couldn't confidently name any of the books of the Bible. So the man is pretending to share the concerns of Christians, but they appear to be quite happy to have him pretend. And I would imagine some of them do sincerely believe that as imperfect a vessel as he obviously is, he's the battering ram that God has provided to take down secular liberal democracy, and it's working. And our prayers are being answered in this peculiar way, and we are getting much, if not everything, that we want. And during the inauguration, if you were paying attention to the religious triumphalism coming out of the mouths of the pastors and even the rabbi, it was fairly alarming. I mean, there's a sense that something like theocracy is in the offing when you hear how these people are talking about their projects, which again are quite separable from the deregulation that Elon Musk is concerned about, which is going to help him get to Mars, right? I mean, like, this is not, Musk is not thinking about the second coming of Christ, and the theocrats are not thinking about getting to Mars, and yet they're both all in for Trump.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I think for the oligarchs that support this movement, they say they see the theocracy and those policies as just the price of doing business. It's a way to get the rank and file on board, and they need them. They need that rank and file desperately. So they're very happy to, you know, partner, you know, and in some cases, it's frankly, I think you'd think it would be an uneasy partnership, but I think they just don't care. They're like, we want our policies that are going to enrich us, and we want to, you know, achieve our goals. Some of them, by the way, like I do think actually, you know, really do care about the so-called culture wars and want to end abortion and all that kind of stuff. But others just, it's just like, well, that's a price of doing business. We got to, you know, have this, we're going to row in the same boat with these other folks, but it's going to help us get where we want to be. I think the real tension is always going to be between the rank and file and their agenda. They want like a better deal for themselves and for the workforce and the funders who just want to basically get richer, frankly, at the expense of a lot of other folks. So I think that's where a lot of the tension is going to be. And I think there will be opportunities like, really, you're going to put the richest man on earth like and his 19-year-old minions in charge of the budget and they're going to go after grandma's Social Security? I just think, you know, while he's, you know, getting a contract for, what, $400 million in Teslas from the State Department and other sort of privileged contracts, I think there are opportunities there to kind of try to spread a bit of the truth and show people what's really going on.
What are you most concerned about at this point?
I mean, truly, I'm concerned about the destruction of our democracy. You know, this is a movement that claims that our national identity is not based on an idea, the great ideals of the American experiment, you know, the ideals that of equality and justice and rule of law, the idea of a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, the idea that our public officials should be subject to the sort of ethics rules and constraints and processes that will actually enable the flourishing of our country, the ideals that have actually promoted prosperity for this country and a sort of like ethos of innovation and the personal liberties that many of us have enjoyed. I mean, our country has never been perfect. Nothing is perfect. But we've had these beautiful ideals to work toward. And I'm really concerned about this idea that we will have a more monarchical, dictatorial form of political power that erodes all of that. I'm also, frankly, really worried about, you know, we're starting to see massive incompetence in our government. It's only been like a few weeks. And we're seeing just extraordinary amounts of corruption, lawbreaking, violations of the Constitution. And I think the Trump experiment, Trump 2.0, is bound to end in a lot of pain for an awful lot of people, because what you're starting to see is that, I won't get into the details, but we saw it here in New York City where
Eric Adams.
Very corrupt. A very corrupt mayor. Adams was told by a new Justice Department Trumpy guy named Emil Bove that, you know, we know you're guilty and, you know, you're going to be prosecuted, but we won't prosecute you for now at least. And we'll sort of put all that on hold as long as you do what we want.
Right.
And there was a, you know, a chief lawmaker here who is actually a Federal Society member. Her name is Danielle Sassoon. She's conservative.
She resigned,
She resigned. And so they put somebody else in there, another conservative, and that person resigned. And then they put someone else, and that person resigned. I mean, so what it shows is that we're going to be left with not just apparatchiks, but incompetence. I mean, you know, Danielle Sassoon may be a Federal Society conservative, but she has a remnant of ethics, right? And those remnants are going to disappear if people who are only loyal to Trump and his inner circle are going to be placed in these very sensitive positions. And, you know, I think there's been a massive propaganda campaign for many years, the idea that government is really terrible. And who was it who said government want to shrink it so small I can drown it in a bathtub? But I think we should be reminded also of the many good things that government does do, and also the many bad things that happen to countries where there is an absence of effective government or just totally corrupt government. I mean, you can see examples of those kinds of places all over the world, and they're not places that most of us would wish to live in necessarily. So I think, you know, that all of that scares me.
Yeah. Well, do you think that any impressive sign of that Elon and Doge have, you know, cut some of the wrong wires and that critical infrastructure
is failing?
Do you think that could then reset our politics?
I mean, they're firing people right and left. Now, of course, you can always find if, you know, is government efficient? Of course. So is the private sector. I mean, there's always room for improvement. And maybe in some of these agents, they could cut, you know, some of the dead wood, like, you know, I don't know, 10%, 5%, and just make everybody else work harder and it's okay. And they'll still, but what they're doing in some instances is firing people who are actually getting stuff done and inhibiting these agencies that have been put into place to actually protect us, in many instances, literally to protect our country, inhibiting them and their key functions.
But I mean, do you think that when you think of the rank and file people right of center who support or who really support the personality cult that used to be the Republican Party, the so-called Trump base, do you think that they could become disillusioned given a certain degree of obvious governmental failure?
I think it's absolutely possible. I mean, they're proposing, what, $800 billion cut to Medicare? It's going to send a whole bunch of old people like onto the street. People are going to die and, you know, be in really desperate situations. Are people going to be better off when their public schools close? I mean, are they going to be better off when the price, you know, prices of goods go up because of these needless trade wars, when our closest allies, overseas allies, and, you know, even ally to our north abandon us because of needless aggression and trade wars? I think there is opportunity for people to see what's happening, but there have to be messengers that make the rank and file understand, know who did this to them and who is fighting for them. And I think that we've frankly seen an absence of a certain amount of leadership on the other side of the political aisle, but it's not that it can't happen. It just needs to sort of become a little more forceful.
One piece of consoling news for me is just that at this point, everyone right of center, there can be no illusion that they haven't gotten what they want, right? I mean, they have, they literally everything that is that the government does at this point is going to be their agents in charge, right? So they're going to own everything that happens for the next little while here, at least. I mean, whether it's 2 years, whether it's 4 years. So it's, yeah, I mean, I guess we should never underestimate the power of delusion and misinformation and disinformation, but it seems patently obvious that they have no one to blame but themselves if things go off the rails here.
That's true, although I think a lot of the rank and file voted on those culture war issues and weren't thinking about, you know, the richest man in the world and his 19-year-old minion sort of marauding through the government. I just don't think that's what they bargained for. A lot of them were believed Trump's promises that the price of eggs would go down, and right. they haven't.
I would say that the vast majority of them right now currently believe that what is happening with DOGE is that we have some of the smartest, most capable people in our country making heroic efforts to save our country from economic ruin. And they're doing it at great personal sacrifice, uncompensated, taking, you know, all the arrows in their back from the libtards like us on the left, who are worried quite unnecessarily about cutting things like USAID. And so that's where they are right now. If Elon and his team of misfits do something which actually harms critical infrastructure, if we can't respond to the next pandemic because Trump and everyone right of center got what they wanted because now RFK Jr. is the genius in charge.
And we're not allowed to talk about it.
Right.
You know, and, big win for the free speech crowd.
And certainly we won't be interested in a vaccine for the bird flu should it jump in, from human to human. They're going to own everything that happens here.
Indeed. We have to remember, though, that if you look at percentages by which presidents win elections, Trump won by a relatively small percentage. He won by a smaller percentage than Biden won in 2020. So, you know, elections are always won at the margins. You know, are the hardest core Trump supporters going to ever change their minds? Probably not. But I think it's really important to communicate to a sector of the American public that simply doesn't know what's going on and might be open to reasoned argument and to facts. It's really important to communicate to them what's going on. I mean, I think, you know, it goes back to something that I was thinking about when we had our earlier conversation about the far left and some of those issues. One of the things that's really important for authoritarian movements to do is to divide people. And one of the ways that they've done this is by cast everyone to the left of them, including like moderate Republicans or even conservative Republicans who don't happen to agree with them on every issue as a kind of deep state bully or woke communist or heretical, you know, sort of just kind of put them all in the same bucket. And that's divided our country. You know, authoritarians want to divide a country because it helps them, you know, divide and conquer, helps them sort of seize illegitimate power. And the role of scapegoating sort of vulnerable minorities has always been useful for authoritarian governance. They might start with an extremely vulnerable minority or a very small minority, but then it sort of expands out. And if you look at sort of war on what they call DEI, yeah, of course, are there some DEI programs that could be criticized for their excesses? Of course there are. But what they're really setting up is a total war on anti-discrimination law. And that's really sad. I mean, it's the same thing with CRT, where CRT is not taught in public K-12. It just isn't. But, you know, there might have been some programs that people like, well, is that really appropriate? But then all of a sudden, you're not teaching Frederick Douglass or Harriet Tubman in these schools. I mean, I think recently there was, you're not teaching about America's what, 250-year history where people were enslaved. And this is a really important part of our history, you know? And Pete Hegseth's wife, I read, sort of caught it out of the corner of my eye. She's visiting some school and they had to take down some presentation or they, you know, were worried about what she might think of this presentation of Harriet Tubman. So they took off like this off the walls. And that's just kind of shocking. You know, but that's what this kind of division does. It's kind of, they are making a boogeyman of some of these issues. You know, however you or I may think of some of the issues at the far margins, there's a much larger agenda here. And I think it's really important to direct our attention to it.
Yeah. I mean, well, I would thread that needle a little differently or with a slightly different emphasis. I mean, I do think that the concerns around DEI and CRT and wokeness, et cetera, are significant. And I think the capture of institutions, I mean, if you look at like, you know, the 1619 Project winning the Pulitzer Prize as the clearest articulation of American history on the topic of slavery and race and Reconstruction, et cetera. I mean, that's just a, you know, if you take an honest historian's view of that, that's a total sacrilege and an embarrassment. I mean, just, you know, Nicole Hannah-Jones is not doing the honest work of an honest historian. This is an activist brief, and it riddled with errors, right? And yet it won the Pulitzer Prize, and you can't take that away from it. And it will still be held up as the truth. And so it's that overreach on the left that I think many sincerely concerned people are reacting to, and they don't want. They would be the last people who would tip over to the right and say, "Yeah, we shouldn't teach Frederick Douglass." Right.
Yes, but are those folks also concerned about like the larger agenda of the sort of the right? Say they vote, let's say they vote on that issue alone, but they're also, you know, I think this movement is really good at capturing people's resentments and hurling them at their political enemies. I mean, I think that, you know, over the last decades, again, we've had this like massive concentration of wealth that has actually made it so much harder for a lot of people. They don't understand why. They're sort of confused about it. They're like, well, it was easier when my dad was, you know, growing, you know, younger, he could buy a house outright. My mom could, you know, didn't have to work for the few years that, you know, kids were little and, you know, the public schools were good and everything worked better. Why is it so much harder for me? And I think people aren't really asking themselves why things are so much harder for them. I mean, I heard once Franklin Graham, he was giving a presentation, it was right in advance of the 2020 election. And he said, we like Donald Trump because we are nostalgic for the late 1950s. And Donald Trump is also nostalgic for the late 1950s. And that's why we support him. Well, if you look at what was happening in the late 1950s, you know, a CEO of a corporation made 20-something times the amount of the average worker. So they could, you know, have a nice house and a boat, maybe a second house, put their kids in private schools, whatever. They could have a pretty nice life. Well, today, the average CEO of a Fortune 500 company makes in the hundreds of times, many hundreds of times, what the average worker makes. And it's actually made life harder for those workers, that kind of vast concentration of wealth. So I think that kind of situation does make people resentful. I do think that Donald Trump is, and this movement, in fact, is pretty good at tapping into sometimes these sort of unexamined prejudices. And I can tell you a story about that if you're interested.
Sure.
So like I was at Moms for Liberty conference. It was in Philadelphia. Moms for Liberty, for anybody who doesn't know, is one of these mom activist groups. They go to school boards and they yell about CRT, you know, that's not really happening in the public schools, but, you know, all the sort of anti-woke stuff. But they're really, if you look at the aims of the organ, they claim to be just, you know, a bunch of moms that met on a playground. They receive support from many of the institutions of the Christian Nationalist Movement, the Leadership Institute, the Bradley, and some other organizations have lent their support to their efforts in different ways. And Lindsay was there with his talk about how everyone to the left of, you know, these moms is a woke communist, et cetera. So I'm sitting there and I'm sitting next to this really nice lady, you know, beautifully dressed. And I sort of ask her, you know, what's your role? Like, how'd you get interest in this? And she was a kind of erstwhile anti-abortion supporter, you know, support of the pro-life movement. And she, you know, signed some petitions and did a little stuff on behalf of ending abortion. But then she said the thing that really got her was she discovered that the Diary of Anne Frank was in a public school library. And I was like, Diary of Anne Frank? It was like, I'm sorry, it's called Diary of a Young Girl, written by Anne Frank. Mm-hmm. It's a story of a young girl who lived, you know, during the Holocaust, you know, 13 years old, hid with her family until she eventually was murdered. And I struggled to sort of, I was like, okay, what was it about that book that you objected to? And she said, it was the lesbian scene. Mm. And I was like, was there a lesbian scene in this diary of a young girl? I didn't recall it. There was a couple of brief lines about Anne and her best friend, and they sort of pledged their friendship, you know, in this way. But it was really about adolescent stuff, curiosity, and there was nothing lesbian about it.
Right.
And, but it, what it shows is that this movement is really great at taking a little something here and there, amplifying it in this crazy way. Now, if you were to really talk to this woman and, you know, longer, if I had been able to talk, I might have found some, I would say, unexamined, certainly homophobia and also unexamined anti-Semitism. But the fact is that this movement is really good at sort of finding a thread of something and then turning it, like blowing it up into a mountain, right? And then all of a sudden she's working for this organization whose aim is to destroy public education. Mm. I mean, it's very clear when you get into the weeds with Moms for Liberty, they aim to, you know, they claim that, look, should public school library books be subject to, like, should we only have books that are appropriate? Of course we should only have books that are appropriate, you know, for the age group. And it depends if it's a high school and an elementary school, et cetera. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, I'm a public school parent, want to make sure the kids are getting good information. Mm. And,
well,
you know,
well, but, what do you do with the fact that there's, about, I mean, certain stories function like super stimuli, right? Which is
right.
Like you just need to hear one of these anecdotes, however representative or non-representative it might be of what's going on at scale and culture. And it's just so crazy and infuriating that it then becomes the crystal around which your politics forms, right?
And I'll give you another example, and especially when we're talking about public school, because the aim, the ultimate aim, is to destroy public education as we know it and to divert taxpayer money to religious and private schools that are free to teach anything they want, including contempt for those who are different. So I was in California at a gathering of an organization. It's a Hispanic outreach for a group called Church United. It's another one of these pastor gatherings. I was in a mega church in Chula Vista. There were 400 Hispanic and Latino pastors there with their families, and they're getting presentations by movement leaders. And they gave us a handout, and they said, these materials are being taught in your kids' public school. And I looked at these materials, and I was like, really? That's awful. Like, I was like, and they have divided, you know, K through 3, you know, 5 through 8, you know, they're showing what's being taught in, you know, all of these different, you know, age groups. I'm looking at this stuff and thinking, this is really not appropriate
at all.
But
what kind? You mean woke
I wouldn't call
DEI
it, I mean, just
stuff,
like, whatever, stuff about sexuality
CRT.
That was completely, it was mostly stuff about sexuality
right. That
was completely inappropriate for those age groups.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to do some fact checking. So I was like, wow, if it's anywhere, it's going to be in San Francisco school district, right? Because that's the most liberal school district. So I go there and I, you know, LA school district, San Francisco, I'm thinking, go to the big centers and do your fact checking. Well, what I discovered is that some of the stuff that they said was being taught at the K through 3 level, which would have been inappropriate, was totally appropriate, would have been appropriate at the high school level. And it's only in high school, but it's also part of another program that's actually outside of the public school, but there might be some link or reference, but it wasn't inappropriate for kids who are like, you know, 10, 11, 12th grade.
Mm.
But it would be inappropriate for, you know, I mean, I'm a parent, you always want to give kids age-appropriate material. And then other stuff, like the most wild, crazy stuff, was not taught in any public school district that I could find anywhere. And yet, this kind of hysteria is used to motivate hostility to public education as a whole. I mean, the aim is really to foster mistrust in public schools in order to soften the ground for wholesale assault. And that project has been going on for decades. Sam, you know, 1979, Jerry Falwell made the agenda clear. He said, I hope to see the day when there are no more public schools, churches will have taken them over, and Christians will be running them. Hostility to public education goes very deep. If you go into this world, you'll find a lot of people talk about public schools as woke indoctrination factories. Now, I put money on the idea that Musk did not send his children to to public schools.
The irony is that it's the private schools that are the woke indoctrination factories. Everyone's free to have as crazy a private school as they want. That's what the theocrats want private schools
Public schools are too focused on like reading and math, you know, on getting good scores so that they can get the state money that they want. I mean, you know, also as a parent, a public school parent, you're not going to love everything that shows up in your kid's curricula, but that's where being an active parent comes in. And, you know, I am a very active parent. We actually homeschooled for a couple of years, not because of our objections to what
was in the school. Not because you're a Christian fanatic?
No. I mean, I think people homeschool for a lot of really good reasons. Yeah. And that's all sometimes. But that sort of homeschool activism has been taken over by a sort of far-right activist cohort, you know, sector. But I just think, you know, as a parent, you need to be engaged in your kid's public school. And if you see something you don't like, then you sort of have conversations with your kids about it. Because nothing is going to be perfect. But, you know, our kids' public school have not been woke indoctrination factories. And when you see the kind of hysteria, the kind of materials that have been held up, they're teaching this in the public school and they've got this, you know, a lot of it is really just, you know, some of it is like making a mountain out of a molehill. Other stuff is just lies. You know, some of it is just lies.
Yeah, well, the lying is really the thing. I mean, it's quite incredible the degree to which lying is occurring, and there's just no penalty for it.
Oh, there's also like right-wing materials in the public school libraries. I remember I was volunteering as a parent to sort of open the boxes and put some of the new books on the shelf. And I remember seeing Callista Gingrich's book. Mm. And I was like, okay, I guess that's going into our public school library. But like, it shows that there's stuff across the political spectrum. But that's okay because, you know, we have a free marketplace of ideas. Mm. As long as it's age appropriate, this is just what it is. So they might find some book that takes a more sort of liberal or progressive slant on something, but right next to it is Callista Gingrich's book. Mm. So they're not objecting to that, are they?
Is there any countervailing Christian movement in the country that can be appealed to that has that will kind of backstop the principles shown by a DA who of the sorts that have just resigned, who are could be appealed to be concerned about the fate of our democracy and the maintenance of democratic principles?
Countervailing religious movement. There are many American Christians who are really upset about what's happening, and honestly, I hear about once a week or more from a pastor somewhere in America who says, I'm really, just this morning.
But do they have mega churches, these pastors, or these?
They tend to sort of people who pastor moderate churches or, you know, mainline churches tend to not want to get too political because they're pastoring to diverse communities. Mm. There are some groups that have sort of come up that, you know, I named some of them at the beginning of our conversation that are trying to sort of message around this. They're not funded. I mean, there's so much money going into sort of right-wing, I would say, Christian nationalist ecosphere, and there's really nothing comparable.
But there is so much money on the other side that when you just look at the successful fundraising and potlatch-level spending of the Harris campaign, I mean, they very quickly raised $1.5 billion and very quickly spent a little bit more than that.
Yeah, but where did they spend it? They didn't spend it on infrastructure. I think, you know, a lot of it went to TV ads.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that the right spends on, they invest in organizations and people so that people know that they can, you know, develop their capacities and build their careers within this movement and secure their economic futures. On the left, people tend to invest in different ways. They invest in, I would say, more technocratic solutions or groups that are operating in silo. And that doesn't really turn out the vote. It's not like those groups aren't working, you know, together with other organizations on voter turnout operations in quite the same way. And also there's a lot of investment in individual politicians. That politician loses their campaign, the money goes away. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they're getting all this money and they don't need it. Like, but if you're investing in an institution that like an organization that like Ralph Reed's organization that runs, or Charlie Kirk's organization and they run voter turnout operations, you know, they'll put their support behind a candidate, but if that candidate loses, then they still have resources to put behind another candidate. And they also, here's the other thing, they campaign not just in election cycles, but all throughout the year. You know, when I was at America Fest, there was this one lady and she was speaking. She said, if the election's in November, don't start in September. You've got to like start in March and don't start with voter stuff. Just have a barbecue in your community. They find trusted voices in their communities. Have a barbecue and just invite Republicans and just get to know everybody so that by the time it's, you know, you're ready for voter outreach, you already have a relationship. So they really focus on relationship building in a way that folks on the other side of the political aisle haven't, broadly speaking. Now, there are some sectors that have, but it's not quite on the same level as on the other side of the political aisle.
Well, Catherine, it would be nice if we could turn this around one barbecue at a time. I think we have our work cut out for us. Is there anything else?
There's a barbecue I'm in.
Is there anything we haven't touched that you, this top of mind, that you think we should, our listeners should be thinking about? I mean, what are you putting your attention to next? I mean, you have a book tour coming up, as I said, which is starting this very week. But what are you going to be focused on for the rest of the year? Do you know what you're doing next?
I think there's enough happening in our political arena to keep all of us busy for quite some time.
Yeah.
How about yourself?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I'm given my other interests, I look for excuses to avert my eyes from politics, but it's getting harder and harder. It's been quite a 4 weeks.
Maybe you should host a barbecue.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, great to meet you, Catherine. Best of luck with the book. And
thank you.
Again, the book is Money, Lies, and God, and it is available now. Thank you for your time, Catherine.
Thank you so much.